invading Africa actually represents, and this is going to get me in trouble, but it was, if you look at how forward it brought the African colonies, it ended up being a net positive. Now, this is, of course, people, it's going to get me in trouble because people somehow think that Africans were living happily ever after and things were great, and then the horrible English, British descended upon and murdered everybody, and the French suddenly murdered everybody, and that just isn't the truth. Obviously, the African nations had slavery, just like the European nations had slavery.
Professor Kayende Andrews, if you could respond.
Well, unfortunately, some people like to make money from being the blackface of white racism, and Candace Owens has a very good history of this. I mean, that is a perfectly nonsensical view of the past. Actually, when Britain came into, when Europe in general, and Britain in particular, came into Africa to enslave people, Europe was behind, was far behind. In the 15th century, Europe was probably the only place in the world in a dark age and came into Africa. And one of the ways, and the main way that Europe takes over is the slave trade. It is draining out Africans to get the commodities, gold, silver, tobacco, et cetera, et cetera, that then enriches Europe so that Europe can colonize. I mean, colonization in Africa is actually for a reason. Most countries on the African continent were not directly colonized by European powers for more than 100 years, because it took centuries of draining out African people, a barbaric system of slavery which never existed on the African continent, which totally not only destabilized Africa so that Europe could take over. The idea that slavery and colonialism somehow positive for Africa is frankly insane. I mean, just look at global inequality. Poorest part of the world is the place, is the so-called sub-Saharan Africa. The place with the lowest life expectancy is so-called sub-Saharan Africa. Anybody with their eyes open looking at this honestly could not possibly think that Africa has benefited from anything that Europe has done.
As we wrap up this show, we have 30 seconds. Kayende Andrews, what would you like to see now? I mean, you have the song God Save the Queen is now changing to God Save the King, with now King Charles III. Your thoughts?
I think it is time now to end the anachronism of what is the British monarchy. 70 years, certainly, I think. And when we say the Commonwealth, that's just the former British Empire. Let's not. I think many countries are going to think about removing the Queen as head of state, including my own country, Jamaica. But I think also in Britain, like this monarchy is a terrible symbol. If we want to have an anti-racist Britain, if we want to learn the lessons from the Black Lives Matter summer, if you want a public space which includes the millions of children of empire in it, you have to get rid of the monarchy.
Kayende Andrews, I want to thank you for being with us, professor of Black Studies in the School of Social Sciences at Birmingham City University. He's the author of The New Age of Empire, How Racism and Colonialism Still Rule the World. We'll link to your piece in Politico, I Don't Mourn the Queen. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Listener-supported community radio.
KBOO News is proud to present our 2022 Citizens Agenda Survey, and we want to hear your thoughts as we approach the midterm election. What do you want candidates to be talking about as they compete for votes? Let us know, and you can be entered into a sweepstakes to win a $50 Visa gift card as a thank you. Plus, it will help our volunteer reporters cover the election with the info that you need to know. Find the survey online at bit.ly/KBOO-survey. That's KBOO's 2022 Citizens Agenda Survey, available online through September 25th at bit.ly/KBOO-survey.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a court of appeals ruling against a $1 billion timber settlement for Oregon counties will stand, new faster TriMet buses make their debut, and Oregon nearly closes the vaccination gap between Latino and white residents. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 19th, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. The Oregon Supreme Court won't take up the appeal of a $1 billion timber case. That means the lower court of appeals ruling will stand and continue to affirm that the, quote, greatest permanent value of Oregon's forest doesn't just mean maximum timber revenue. The lead-up to this court case goes back to the 30s and 40s, when many Oregon counties gave their forested land to the state to manage, and in return reaped profits from the logging done on those lands. That revenue was millions of dollars annually. In a lawsuit in 2019, 13 counties sued the state, saying that the profits they were getting to fund programs from logging wasn't enough and that the state was mismanaging the forest lands. A Linn County jury agreed and ordered a $1 billion settlement to those counties. Oregon was entrusted to create, quote, the greatest permanent value from these lands. But a Court of Appeals decision earlier this year decided that the obligation to the greatest permanent value didn't equal maximum timber profits like the counties claimed. By not taking up the case, the Oregon Supreme Court has affirmed this idea. Conservation groups heralded the appeals decision, saying it squashes the idea that Oregon forest lands are only as valuable as the timber that they produce. The Oregon Department of Justice, who appealed the decision, agreed, noting that the state's forests serve a range of environmental, recreational, and economic purposes. Wildfires and excessive heat are making farm worker jobs in Washington state more difficult, and they want more protections from these hazards. Eric Tegedoff has the story.
Washington state farm workers are facing harsh conditions in the midst of wildfires and late summer heat. They're calling for greater protections from the elements. Alfredo Juarez is a farm worker in Northwest Washington and organizer with Community to Community Development. He says the wildfire smoke was a major issue last week, but farm workers were still in the fields.
There was an alert for people to stay home and only leave if it's an emergency to go out. But other than that, to stay home, the farm workers kept on working. They didn't have masks to work, so it's very dangerous.
Juarez says his organization has been handing out N95 masks. He says the high temperatures have also been an issue. Washington state has implemented heat rules that require employers to allow more rest periods if temperatures are 89 degrees or higher. But Juarez says the temperature threshold is too high and should come down to 75 degrees. Edgar Franks is with the farm worker union Familias Unidas por la Justicia. He is urging Governor Jay Inslee to declare a climate emergency in the state, especially given the frequencies of recent weather-related disasters.
This is not a problem that's just going to go away overnight. So we need the state to really take this seriously and move resources and have a clear plan to address specifically the damage that climate change is going to be doing to not only the environment, but to workers and communities.
The governor's office says they are looking for ways to protect farm workers, but that declaring a climate emergency is not currently on the table. Frank says not responding to the changing climate hurts agriculture.
Agriculture used to have weather patterns and kind of a predictability, and now everything is up in the air. So that not only hurts industry, but it also hurts workers.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Regional bus service in the Portland metro area has a new high-capacity, faster bus line taking shape. TriMet launched its new FX service this weekend. KBOO's Josh Salem has more.
A new TriMet bus service launched over the weekend. TriMet FX uses extra-long buses made up of two sections linked by an accordion-like joint. They stretch some 60 feet long and can fit 60% more riders than traditional TriMet buses. The FX service also features faster routes and all-door boarding, meaning passengers can board the bus in any of the three doors instead of just the doors near the driver. FX stations are only located in areas with high rider demand. Transportation officials and local politicians celebrated the new service at Portland Community College's Southeast Campus over the weekend. The lineup included several speakers, ceremonial line dancing, and a musical performance by the Paper Bellows, an accordion quartet. The Saturday event ended with several attendees filing into two FX buses for a debut ride in the city. The first TriMet FX bus line, FX2 Division, connects downtown, southeast, East Portland, and Gresham via the Division Street corridor. Buses run every 12 minutes. FX2 vehicles operate on R99, a renewable diesel made up of 99% renewable resources like natural fats, vegetable oils, and greases. The other 1% consists of petroleum. TriMet still plans to transition into a zero-emission bus fleet by 2040. The new line comes at a time during which TriMet has been struggling with a major operator shortage, In August, TriMet officials said the agency was short 350 drivers. The Max Light Rail service is also strained by staffing issues, and multiple late arrivals have been noted recently as a result. The FX2 Division bus line is part of a TriMet $175 million project, which also includes several safety improvements, like protected intersections and new sidewalks. Most of those funds came from federal grants. TriMet invested $24 million and the City of Portland $17 million. In contracting out construction jobs for the project, TriMet prioritized companies certified by the Federal Disadvantaged Business Enterprise Program, which is made up of businesses owned by people who are Black, Latino, Native American, or Asian. Women also qualified. More than three-quarters of the businesses that worked on the Division Transit project were certified DBE. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Oregon has nearly closed the COVID vaccination gap between Latino and white residents, according to new reporting from OPB. Latino populations now have a vaccination rate of 72%. That's just 4 points behind the white population of the state, which has 76% of adults vaccinated. Back in June of 2021, though, those figures were bleaker. Just 45% of Hispanic and Latino Oregonians were vaccinated, 14 points behind their white counterparts. The Oregon Health Authority credits closing the gap to partnering with trusted community organizations. 170 community and faith-based orgs received funding for the effort. They said it made a difference to have vaccine clinics where folks were already getting medical care they trusted, rather than pushing people to get their shot at a mass vaccination site like the Portland Convention Center. In certain counties, though, a lag between the Latino and white vaccination rate continues. Coos, Sherman, Gilliam, Wheeler, and Curry counties still see a 20-ish percentage point difference between these groups, and the Oregon Health Authority says they're still not sure why. But they do have a proven strategy for increasing vaccinations for Hispanic and Latino Oregonians. They say their next challenge will be bringing up the rate of COVID and standard vaccines for Latino children across the state. Both the University of Oregon and its students section have separately apologized to Brigham Young University for an offensive chant that students yelled at a Saturday football game. Brigham Young University, or BYU, is a Mormon university with a primarily Mormon student body. At a game on Saturday, U of O students allegedly chanted "F the Mormons." The chant even prompted the governor of Utah to tweet that, quote, "religious bigotry is alive and celebrated in Oregon." The U of O and its students section, the Pitt Crew, issued apologies to BYU. The Pitt Crew tweeted, quote, "We do not condone or support any hateful speech directed towards someone's religion and are ashamed of those who participated." It's not the first time this chant has been wielded against BYU's football team either. USC fans chanted the same refrain at a game last season. That university has also since apologized. President Joe Biden attended the funeral for Queen Elizabeth II today. With that story and more, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times. Mourners outside Westminster Hall, where Queen Elizabeth is lying in state. World leaders will gather in London today for her funeral. President Joe Biden is scheduled to meet with UK Prime Minister Liz Truss later this week at the UN General Assembly. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is defending his decision to fly Venezuelan migrants from Texas to Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts. Critics say deceiving the migrants to get them on the planes for the stunt may have actually been illegal. But DeSantis is blaming the administration's immigration policy.
This is a massive policy failure by the president.
Former President Donald Trump campaigned in Youngstown, Ohio, Saturday for Senate contender J.D. Vance and Ohio Representative Jim Jordan.
If you want to continue this national catastrophe, vote for the radical left Democrats. Do it. Go ahead. You won't have a country left.
Rail workers are set to vote on a White House brokered deal between unions and railroad companies this week. If they fail to ratify the new contract, more than 100,000 workers could still go on strike. But Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg says the agreement addresses their major concerns.
Because of the way railroad workers are scheduled, it can be very difficult for them to get time off, even unpaid time off sometimes when they need it. That was a major issue at the table and one that was resolved.
A New York Times Siena College poll shows more Latinos, especially younger males, are moving away from the Democratic Party. More than a third of Hispanic voters agree more with the GOP on crime and policing. And president of Bienvenido U.S., Abraham Enriquez, says they're most focused on the cost of living.
Inflation, as it has reached a 40-year high, has really crushed Hispanic budgets across the country.
Still, close to 60% plan to vote for Democrats this fall, compared with a third who plan to vote Republican. South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham says Americans would accept a national abortion ban at 15 weeks. His bill to put one in place has drawn fire, but the Conservative Center for Urban Renewal and Education has come out in favor. The group's president, Star Parker, says abortion advocacy groups are taking responsibility and dignity away from Black and brown communities.
And they force taxpayers to give them money so that they can then continue with aborting mostly those that are Black and brown.
I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in depth. Then at 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, Prison Pipeline. And at 7, stick around for Let's Talk About Race. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 60 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a high of 85. Today in history, in 1796, President George Washington's farewell address was printed across America as an open letter to the public. It spanned a variety of topics, including the dangers posed by political parties and sectionalism. The quote of the day is from Washington's farewell address. It read, quote, "Promote then as an object of primary importance institutions for the general diffusion of knowledge. In proportion as the structure of government gives force to public opinion, it's essential that public opinion should be enlightened." King County, Washington will pay the Suquamish tribe $5 million for a sewage spill in the Puget Sound. With that story and more, it's Daniel Montano with National Native News.
For National Native News, I'm Daniel Montano in for Antonio Gonzalez. Washington State's most populous county is getting ready to pay more than $5 million to settle a lawsuit threatened by the Suquamish tribe over more than 6 million gallons of sewage spilled into the Puget Sound. The Seattle Times reports the tribe filed an intent to sue in 2020, documenting almost a dozen times sewage overflowed from the West Point treatment plant in Seattle over 2018 and 19. The proposed settlement includes a timeline for almost $600 million in improvements to the plant, including new pipes, pumps, batteries, and other power supplies to keep pumps running in the event of a power outage. The spills generally happen during foul weather or blackouts. About half of the $5 million will go to a mitigation fund held by the tribe. The other half will go toward a new environmental project of the county's choosing, and the county will pay $240,000 of the tribe's legal fees. The proposed settlement, which was discussed and agreed to by the tribe and county officials earlier this year, passed the county's Environment Committee on Thursday and goes to full council for a vote as early as later this month. Actor and activist Sasheen Littlefeather formally accepted an apology by officials at the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. The event at the Academy Museum comes nearly 50 years after she was booed and professionally boycotted for her speech during the 1973 Oscar Awards broadcast on behalf of Marlon Brando, declining his award for Best Actor. Casting director and former president of the Academy, David Rubin, read from a letter of apology first presented to Littlefeather in June.
"For too long, the courage you showed has been unacknowledged. For this, we offer both our deepest apologies and our sincere admiration."
Rubin said the Academy is at an inflection point for inclusion and representation. Little Feather's 1973 speech called attention to the ongoing conflict at Wounded Knee, South Dakota, and called out the poor representation of Native people in popular media. At the recent event, Little Feather said she understood the gravity of her role that night.
I was representing all Indigenous voices out there, all Indigenous people, because we have never been heard in that way before. And if I had to pay the price of admission, then that was okay, because those doors had to be open.
Billed as a healing event, her appearance included a discussion with producer Bird Runningwater, the co-chair of the Academy's Indigenous Alliance and former head of the Sundance Institute's Native Lab. The Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nation is fighting for mineral rights against the state of North Dakota. North Dakota has reaffirmed an ownership claim over the bed of the Missouri River as it flows through Fort Berthold Indian Reservation, the home of MHA Nation, despite legal and historical precedent, and a memo from the U.S. Department of Interior that confirms tribal ownership. Inforum News reports that more than $115 million is at stake in oil and gas royalties. The dispute is pending before a U.S. District Court judge in a lawsuit filed by the tribe after the Trump administration reversed decades of federal policy, recognizing the tribe's ownership in a series of legal decisions going back to 1936 and two treaties from 1825 and 1851. The Biden administration reversed that Trump order back in February of this year, and the tribe has been trying to get a full accounting of royalties owed ever since. But the state's Solicitor General wrote a letter to oil and gas producers claiming ownership based on the Constitution's Equal Footing Doctrine, which declares a state holds ownership of navigable waters within its boundaries. For National Native News, I'm Daniel Montano.
A hailstorm in August devastated the small eastern Oregon town of Willowa, but people in surrounding towns have come out to help their neighbors. Eric Tegedoff has more on their recovery.
After a devastating hailstorm in eastern Oregon, community members are lending each other a helping hand. In mid-August, a severe storm dropped hail the size of baseballs on the town of Wallawa. It damaged nearly every vehicle in the town of 800, smashed windows, and battered roofs. Stephen Cleaver is the pastor of Lustine First Presbyterian Church, which has congregants from nearby Wallawa.
I contacted everybody, made sure everybody was okay. What I found out was that people were highly traumatized. This was a traumatic event. It just shook people because it was so violent. I mean, we're talking 10 minutes, and it basically decimated the town.
He says luckily no one was seriously injured. After checking in with everyone he could, Cleaver headed an effort to raise money. He says so far they've raised $70,000 and handed out $500 vouchers. The most pressing need for people was transportation, since many in the community work outside of town. However, Cleaver says it wasn't immediately apparent how hard folks' roofs had been hit. They'll need to be repaired or at least patched before the cold, rainy winter starts. Cleaver says people from surrounding communities immediately stepped up and did what they could.
People put up plywood over windows. They helped put tarps over roofs. People jumped in and provided rides to people who needed rides for work.
Although the hailstorm damaged nearly every part of Wallawa, it did not reach the threshold for federal aid. The damage was assessed at less than $7.5 million, meaning federal emergency management agency support is not available. Cleaver says the type of support doled out from FEMA is typically for bigger, more urban communities.
This was a devastating event, but not in the eyes of the world at large. And so this is the kind of situation that falls through the cracks. And how could we revamp some of the criteria, for example, for federal aid that could take into account smaller communities, rural communities, remote communities?
So far, a GoFundMe fundraiser set up by Marika Straw has raised more than $36,000 for the people of Wallawa. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A New Orleans group helps families feed infants during emergencies. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. During a hurricane or other natural disaster, infants are vulnerable. They have specific nutritional needs, and they're susceptible to infection.
And so when you're the parent of a baby and you're living through a disaster, you worry so much about your baby's health. You're constantly worrying about what they will eat and when they will eat and how they will eat. And you also worry that they'll get sick.
Malaika Ludman is a program coordinator at the New Orleans-based Birthmark Doula Collective. She says that during a disaster, parents who are breast or chest feeding a baby may worry they're not making enough milk because they're so stressed. And families who are formula feeding may struggle to find supplies.
They need clean water. They need a way to heat the water. They need a steady supply of formula.
To help families, the Birthmark Doula Collective offers a program called Infant Ready. It trains emergency responders on how to support breastfeeding during a crisis and how to manage the distribution of formula donations. And it distributes emergency feeding kits to families with breast milk storage bags, disposable ice packs, and other supplies, so families have the resources they need to safely feed their babies, even during a crisis. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
This month, the Census Bureau released new data showing a sharp drop in poverty last year. Federal pandemic policies played a role, and analysts say they should be made permanent to make sure that that progress doesn't slip away. Mike Moen has more on these advocacy efforts in Minnesota.
On the heels of a promising poverty report, there are renewed calls to make permanent certain pandemic policies that help struggling families in Minnesota and around the country. Last week, an annual Census Bureau report showed that child poverty fell sharply last year to a record low of 5.2%. Arlok Sherman, with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, says that was largely fueled by the temporary expansion of the federal child tax credit. He notes other census information revealed monthly payments from the credit helped eligible households meet basic needs.
Families were saying, we're spending this money to buy food, we're spending it to pay the rent, we're buying books for our children's school.
But the expanded credit expired, and Sherman predicts an uptick in poverty this year if Congress doesn't revisit the issue. In Minnesota, the Children's Defense Fund urges the legislature to use surplus money to create a separate state child tax credit. Opponents, including GOP lawmakers, say expanding government spending long-term will contribute to more inflation woes, hurting family budgets. But Sherman argues global supply chain issues and other factors are playing a role in the current inflation problem, and he says if future investments are geared more for low-income families rather than the large pandemic relief bills, they shouldn't register negative economic waves. Instead, he says it would help the country down the road.
The good news is that now we've shown we actually know how to reduce that kind of poverty and poverty-related stress.
He says moving forward with this blueprint will result in better outcomes for kids, building on some of the progress that was seen even prior to the pandemic. In Congress, lawmakers who support reviving the child tax credit are looking for new opportunities to negotiate, including pending changes to certain business tax breaks. Mike Moen, Minnesota News Connection.
A new piece of legislation in Congress is creating provisions for retirement planning across the U.S. Some state-level planning, though, has laid the groundwork needed to get this bill to succeed. Edwin J. Vieira has more in Connecticut.
A new piece of legislation in Congress will help people across the U.S. prepare for retirement with greater ease. The EARN Act, short for Enhancing American Retirement Now, reduces requirements for part-time workers to participate in retirement plans, allows for penalty-free emergency withdrawals from retirement accounts, and encourages small businesses to adopt retirement plans. AARP Connecticut State Director Nora Duncan feels this will expand people's options when they consider retirement planning.
While Social Security continues to be the bedrock of retirement income for most American workers and their families, individuals want and need additional retirement income sources in order to live the way they need to as they age.
The EARN Act comes just as Connecticut became one of a few states with state retirement plans, which Duncan feels could help businesses of all sizes establish some kind of retirement plan. Other states with these kinds of plans include California, Oregon, and Illinois. Although these plans are relatively new, data from the Pew Research Center shows these plans have seen steady growth since their inception. While the EARN Act is still relatively new, Duncan sees some potential opposition to it coming from the finance sector regarding how people receive receive their statements. According to data from AARP, more than half of adults with employer-sponsored retirement plans would prefer paper statements. She feels some benefits to the new bill come with drawbacks as well.
Being able to qualify for retirement savings at work in 2 years of part-time work for the company rather than three really makes it easier to save for retirement. But this isn't particularly helpful to the many older workers who can only find part-time work.
She adds this also might not be helpful for people who have to work part-time due to caregiving responsibilities. But the EARN Act has received a great deal of bipartisan support in Congress, providing the possibility of its safe passage in the coming months. I'm Edwin J. Vieira, Connecticut News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 19th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and David Rosenberg. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Mike Moen, Daniel Montano, Nadia Ramlagan, Edwin J. Vieira, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. Thank you. If you would like to become a member and support your local community radio station and content like this, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top